You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome back, the 14 Times' televisual critic and reviewer, Stu Neville, to find out what he's been enjoying on his telly box recently. We'll also discuss some underappreciated gems from films and shows back in the 70s, including Dr. Fibes, The House on Marsh Road, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, and much, much more, before returning to the modern day for some of his particular favourites over the last few months. Thank you as always to Stu for joining me this week. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual, and thank you to each and every one of you for your continued support. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for your Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's join Stu as he tells us about some of the tantalisingly terrifying shows he's been enjoying recently. The 60s and 70s are well known for some classics in the annals of horror and thriller, but it seems that only the certain films receive continual adulation, from psycho rip-offs to overlooked monster classics. Joining me to examine some of these is the 14 Times' resident couch potato these days, Stu Neville. Stu, welcome back.
Good evening, my friend. How are you doing?
I'm very well. I very carefully nearly tripped myself up there. I was going to say coach again.
Coach potato, I know. That's twice they've done it in the actual mag. They describe me as the coach potato, which is kind of like a very weird...
Hanging around Bristol bus station.
I know, bless. But I'll take that. That's fine by me. No problem whatsoever.
I mean, obviously, with your regular column, Stu, you probably watch more strange things than you used to as for entertainment purposes, I would imagine, these days. Often... Sometimes not through choice, it would seem.
No, well, sometimes I'm given kind of guidance of what it is I need to look at. I mean, like, for example, the Amityville documentary on BBC has gone absolutely bonkers. So, I mean, that's it's too late for the next issue, but it's it'll be in the April issue because it's made such a massive stir, in the same way as Uncanny did. You know, suddenly Uncanny just it had always been there for us guys because we knew about Danny.
Yeah.
You know, and we'd been listening to him on Radio 4 for ages. And then suddenly it appears on the TV and just goes absolutely meteoric, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So suddenly that's when I get called in. So we can be aware of stuff for a long time. Mm. And suddenly it catches the attention and off it goes.
Yeah.
But normally I'm given fairly free rein is what I want to talk about. Because if you look at most of the output, of course, a lot of it's very, very similar.
Mm.
So especially like the ghost hunting stuff. I tend not to do ghost hunting stuff because so much of it is basically the bloody same. it's people in baseball caps in low light yelling at each other, and that's effectively what it becomes, you know.
Yeah.
But however, the next one I've actually just reviewed one called My Ghostly Footsteps, which is currently on Prime and Apple, and it's actually quite an interesting one because it's quite sincere, and it's made by a documentary maker called Guy Gilbert, who was terrified one night his grandparents. He was staying in his grandparents' house in quite a secluded area. They had to go out. One of their pets was poorly. They had taken to the vet. And he was on his own. And he had a ghostly encounter, which terrified him. He was about 8 or 9, so he was really, really frightened. Mm. And anyway, 50 years later, he's trying to work out what it was that he saw. Mm. And he enlists a couple of ghost hunters, including a couple of people from South Bristol Paranormal, including the lovely Karen Besant, who I know. She's lovely, absolutely great.
Yeah.
So they're quite, you know, they do the Jamaican stuff and so on. So they're,
yes,
you know, they're pretty decent. So show the tools of trade, and then they bring in Richard Felix to sort of boost it. And I know I'm quite unfair to Richard Felix quite a lot of the time. And this one, I've got to say, he manages to nearly go full Partridge a few times, but it doesn't quite happen. But there's, if anybody watches it, I particularly recommend you look for the table tilting experiment. And it's, yes, it's quite something to behold. Mr. Felix makes it that way, I have to say.
Yes. Having had the pleasure of speaking with Richard, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago now, he was everything I expected and much more.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, no, you can't. You cannot deny his enthusiasm.
It's infectious. Infectious.
It is. Absolutely, yes. I go along with that.
Yeah. I was quite surprised in your last column, Stu, that I saw two of my favourites. One, I think, is one of those that if you're into Bigfoot, you know who Justin Chernopesky is these days, because I stumbled across his first documentary through YouTube recommending it several years ago.
Yes.
And so I followed Mountain Beast Mysteries ever since.
Yeah.
You know, he does some brilliant content fairly regularly as well. And you can see his progression from somebody starting out to quite a slick operator these days.
Yes.
With the presentations and the thing he does. But I always liked his very grounded and knowledgeable.
He's treating it as a wildlife documentary, isn't he?
Yes.
You know, he's quoting it the same way as those two guys did who photographed the snow leopards in the Himalayas.
Mm.
They knew they were there. They just didn't know where the hell they were. And basically they spent effectively, a couple of years just waiting for them to walk in a shot because that's all they could do. And they did. So Chernopesky's got exactly the same attitude. It's a case of, look, this thing, as he says, doesn't he, in the first one, you know, assuming it's there, he said it will see me long before I see it. Mm. It will hear me long before I hear it. If it doesn't want to be seen, it will not be seen.
Mm.
So I have to stay absolutely still and wait for it to come to me. You know, and that's basically what he does, isn't it? You know,
absolutely. Absolutely. And he's very good as well. I mean, I've learned a lot about where he's from, like these people that just decide to bugger off into the woods and build themselves a cabin, and the Canadian Fire Service have to go in there and pull them down.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah. I know. He's committed to what he does, and it's his kind of Zen-like thing about it, isn't it? It's very, you know, he's trying to find the answers, but he's doing it in a very methodical way.
Yeah.
And that's good to see. We need more of that.
Absolutely. He's been on my hit list for a couple of years, so I'm always hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other one was obviously one I think, as you mentioned in your review, Stuart, is criminally underrated, which was the Operation Mungo show.
Yes.
It's one of them that sometimes you'll see these series pop up on Animal Planet or Discovery.
Yeah.
And they're on for, I think that one, there's 6 or 7 episodes.
Mm.
And they just appear and then they bugger off.
They do.
And you're like, hang on, this was really quite good. And like you say, in his show, he was very, because of his experience as a wildlife photographer and general explorer, he had a bit of Indiana Jones about him.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, definitely.
But he knew his stuff and he knew about animals and he was very, very well connected in regards to the way he would treat the local people, and he would always seek advice from them and get their opinions rather than following on from books that had been written by explorers or whatever. And I always like that kind of approach because I think if you're trying to get to the heart of a mystery you don't really know about, that's where you should be starting.
Oh, totally. Totally. And I think this is what I've always liked about, what I like about Josh Gates. I think Josh Gates has done very much the same sort of thing.
Mm.
He's sort of started as, I said myself right at the beginning, the very first Destination Truth, the very first series of it, he was very shouty, wasn't he? He was very kind of like, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But throughout that series, the arc went very slowly down and he took it down a bit and it became very much a case of a travelogue. And it's a case of, and this, and I will always give him props for this and I will always mention that, is that when they do find out what it was they just photographed, you know, it's on low light, it's that they will say, actually, we found out this was one of the crew.
Mm.
And they'll just say it, you know, and that's brilliant. That is something that is so refreshing.
Yeah.
But he's now gone away from the mysteries to a degree, hasn't he? He's now doing more, you know, sort of like curious documentaries.
Yes.
So he's going to places like Petra and stuff like that, trying to work out how he built it and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
Which I get the idea is what he always really wanted to do, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's an archaeologist by trade. He just likes strange things as well. And I love both the things he does, because obviously he's got the Destination Unknown, which is more to do with things like Petra and searching for lost Aztec temples, which also has also covered some very odd things that I was never aware of. Like, he did one episode about this book, The Secret, which is obviously very similar to what we had here with Kit Malt. Was it Kit Malting?
Kit Malthouse, yeah.
Kit Malthouse.
Oh, no, Kit Malthouse is the secretary for bloody health, wasn't he?
Was it so Kit Malting?
No, it was Kit Williams. Kit Williams.
I was going to say, I thought I was going to say the secretary for states as well. There's not many people called Kit, and we can't even get him right. So I'd never heard of this, but obviously it was very similar. The difference with this is I think there were eight prizes and they've only found three.
That's right. Yeah, but there was a bit of a controversy about Masquerade, wasn't there? Because the guy who found it was like a friend of his ex-wife or something, wasn't it?
Yes.
So it's kind of like, you know, which spoils a little bit. But my favourite detail of that was always the fact that the only other person who knew where it was buried was Bamba Gascoigne. And it's just like, of all the people to jump up, yeah, fair enough, Bamba Gascoigne. What a bloke.
You know? Absolutely. The fulcrum that keeps all those students under control back in those halcyon days of University Challenge.
I'll tell you what, though, I'm coming back to Masquerade. I remember when it came out because loads of us got it. For, I was about, how old was I? I'd have been about 12 or 13 when it came out. And loads of us got it for Christmas. And it was kind of, and it's school. And there's a bunch of 13-year-olds got, all right, I know where it is. I think, you know, because, you know, when you're a teenager, you think in two sort of ways, don't you? You think really local think basically global. So we're all sat there. Well, it's either like in like Guatemala, all right, under some trees, or it's under Asda. One of the things. And we'd have these earnest discussions. It's just like, oh, it was wonderful. It kept me busy for ages, I must admit.
Yeah.
Until I discovered Mayfair, and then it kind of.
That's a different kind of discovery, Stu, and we'll move on, I think. I mean, when I said there in the introduction that there is a strange thing about the 60s and 70s. As a lover of horror, I am amazed when you meet people who say they really like horror films, and they'll probably only know a dozen from the 60s through to the mid-70s, I think, before Halloween and Carrie turn up.
Yes.
And terrify everybody. It's a very strange period for some people because you've obviously got loads of Hammer, you've got loads of Roger Corman, you've got Hitchcock dipping his toe in and out again, and yet there are some absolutely phenomenal ones, and one that I had never seen until the beginning of last year. I had a phase where I ended up watching three films that I've heard about for years and never seen, and then Talking Pictures showed all three of them. Which was The Ghost of Mrs. Muir.
Yes.
Which is one of them films, I think, why have I never seen this till I'm 50?
And funny enough, we were talking about it just last night, wasn't it? Because my friend Ruth posted about it.
Yes.
And she says hello, by the way.
Oh.
She's a big fan.
Yes, hello, Ruth.
She said exactly the same thing. You know, it's like, why people just don't know about it. It's a fabulous film. It's a beautiful film.
Yeah. And when I mentioned it, one of my friends is Stephen Singleton, who's one of the original members of ABC.
Ah, okay.
It's his favourite film ever.
Mm.
And you think, why have I not? Because it's got a stellar cast.
Mm.
And when you watch it, it's really funny. It's very supernatural. And it's bloody tear-jerkingly lovely at the end.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely wonderful. It's funny because we were talking about this, actually, funny enough, and about how there's other films like A Matter of Life and Death, which is one of my favourite films of all time, Stairway to Heaven in the States, of course. And I love that film. I've always loved it. And my top 10 of films and TV programmes especially just vacillates all over the bloody place. But it's consistently, that one is always somewhere towards the top.
Yes.
And it's because it's so outrageous. But it's Powell and Pressburger had a way of keeping the fantasy going.
Yep.
It was within its own little bounds. And once you understood that was the environment in which it was, it's like a snow globe. You completely accept what's going on in it.
Yeah,
that's why they're brilliant, to just creating that world and then you're within it. But it's funny, we're talking about who you'd like to be. Within that, would you like to be would you like to be Carter, the guy who survived death? And you mentioned Nicholas Alcamedo earlier on, didn't you?
Yes.
He informed that. Yeah. But would you like to be Carter? But actually, I always wanted to be Dr. Frank Reeves. Always wanted to be Roger Livesey because I want to be a bloke with his own camera obscura in the roof. Right, completely surrounded by books, but can spend his entire day either playing ping pong with Kim Hunter, or just researching stuff. That would be my dream. I'd love that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And also look really good in a tweed jacket and a V-neck sweater. I've got to say, I look pretty damn good in that. So, I mean, that would suit me absolutely down to the ground. But the film itself is just so bloody good. And every time you see it, you will spot other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's the use of black and white versus colour, which obviously over the, you know, Wizard of Oz became most famous for doing.
Yeah.
But it does it actually better because it allows you to go between the worlds.
Yes.
Constantly.
Yeah.
And the way it does it is just so subtly done. And it's clever. It's a clever. Yeah. And it's a short film. It's only an hour and a half long.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And it brings a tear to my eye every time I watch it. I watch it at least once a year. Stu, I've had the honour of seeing it at our local independent cinema, the showroom here, on the big screen, which made me, my heart flutter with joy watching it.
It's wonderful.
And then I stumbled on an incredible Blu-ray box set in a well-known chain of British second-hand entertainment retailers for £10. Yep. And I could not get out that shop fast enough.
Oh, mate. Wow.
Put that next to my The Third Man box set that I found in the same shop for another stupidly cheap price.
And you're not going to tell anybody which this shop is, are you, Paul?
No.
No, you're not.
No. Not if you live in South Yorkshire. You can bugger off.
It'd be a long way to go to get a box set, I must admit.
But that's one of those. And the other one I stumbled across, and I didn't know much about it, is The House in Marsh Road. Stuart, have you ever seen this?
I have not. I've heard of it. I have never seen it.
And I was like, right, I saw the blurb on the planner, and I thought, yep. A woman inherits a house inhabited by a poltergeist who saves her life. And I thought, well, there's not many films like that you come across anyway.
No.
And essentially, it's about this woman, her aunt dies, and she leaves her the house, and she's made up because she's been struggling to get her own place for ages, and it's this beautiful old Edwardian mansion type thing, loads of drawing rooms and things, not flash, pretty well decorated in a modern style.
Okay.
But her partner is a cad, to say the least. He's one of those, he's a professional, he's going to be famous eventually, he just needs to borrow a fiver. He's one of them.
Yes.
And essentially, in all he wants to do is sell it. So he knows she can get the money, he can fleece her out of it all, and then he can run off with this floozy he's met in the local bar where he spends most of his days pretending to be a writer, Stu.
Yeah, I don't go to the pub anymore. Don't come on.
And the great thing about this is that the poltergeist knows this and hates him.
Okay.
And so it starts off fairly gentle, where it's like he tries to sit down, the chair's moved, he goes to get his glasses, they're broken, he reaches for his drink, it's not there anymore. But it begins to escalate as he starts to have an affair with another woman.
Yeah.
It really begins to escalate, and essentially he's trying to bump her off, basically, and she won't sell the house. She loves it, she won't sell it. I'll not spoil the ending, but I have to say, I did not expect the last 15 minutes, because it kind of goes from gentle, amusing, slightly supernatural comedy thriller to the last 10 minutes being quite a terrifying horror film.
Wow. Lots under that. Definitely. Okay. Yeah. It's all going in the show notes, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So it's one of those that there are so many films of this era that get completely missed like that, because I'm not aware of another sort of supernatural protective story in a similar thing. It's one of those that you think, well, with so much being remade and rebooted or whatever, it's one of those films where you think, why has nobody gone back to this?
Yeah. Yes. No, you're quite right. They always go for the most obvious, don't they? And it's kind of like, some of them are just fabulous. I mean, you know, remake, I've got a problem with remakes generally. I mean, especially when they've, well, I mean, for Davy Oyster still, for example, remake it, oh, fine, you've got all the effects, you've got all the CGI, but it just didn't work nearly as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even with Keanu doing his best, and John Cleese, you know, and all that kind of, as much as I love Cleese, it was kind of like, you know, you've shoehorned him in, haven't you, really, just to sort of like get a certain kudos. I like what they did with Gort. I thought Gort was, you know, they could do more, because Gort always was going to be hampered by the technology of the time, wasn't he, when they made the original? Because, I mean, I know Locke Martin, the guy inside the suit, was actually physically very weak. He was so tall that his bones weren't strong. So the Gort you see actually in the film most of the time is a fiberglass model. It's only when he moves that it's Locke Martin. And when he has to pick up the girl after she faints, they had to get a stuntman in to do that because Locke Martin wasn't strong enough.
Yeah.
Which is kind of ironic. But then, So yeah, Gort, fine, yeah, lovely. But what they did is they took a really good story and they just extended it too far, didn't they? And they just moved it and stuff like that. And they made it an eco story rather than a military story. And it actually that diluted it in a funny sort of way. You know, it's strange. But yeah, and of course another Robert Wise one. Robert Wise, do not just quick dive in. Robert Wise, right? So this is a bloke who made The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah.
Right. He made The Haunting, the most frightening film I still maintain ever made by anybody ever. You know, the 1963 Haunting. He made that, and it is terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, he made that. He made those two. Then he made The Sound of Music.
Yes.
Then he made West Side Story.
Yeah. Did he do The Guns of Navarone as well?
He did a lot of Guns of Navarone. He just directed everything. You know, he sort of like, he didn't make Dougal and the Blue Cat, but he might as well have, you know what I mean? He was an amazing man.
Did a James Bond film as well, didn't he?
I'm trying to, yeah. Was it Dr. No? Was it the first one, possibly?
Yeah.
Might have been. I'll have to check.
Yeah. It was clearly, if Kubrick's busy, get me Wise.
Absolutely. And in fact, Wise will do it a bloody sight quicker. He'll do it on budget, you know, and he'll film it in America, which, of course, Kubrick wouldn't do. So it's, yeah, absolutely. But no, you're right. There's lots of ones which are ripe, probably for remakes, but should you? That's the question, isn't it? It's kind of like, actually, they're good as they are. It's like when they made RoboCop 10 years after the original RoboCop. It's like, what are you doing?
Did they? I don't remember that, Stu. No, that's never
RoboCop
happened.
1986 is a fabulous, fabulous film. Yes. Right? Apart from anything else, the fact that it's a comedy, which people tend to miss.
Yes.
Because it is. It's a satire.
It's a satire. Yeah.
As is Starship Troopers. Most of Verhoeven's stuff is actually a satire.
Yeah.
And then they literally remade RoboCop. It wasn't 10 years later. It was probably about 10 years ago. So it would have been, yeah.
Yeah, it was 2012. I know all about it, Stu.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous, isn't it? Just like mad. You know, and it's it stopped being about sort of like identity and like satire and like, you know, privatization of everything. It became about, or somebody said it became about a disabled man with a gun. It just basically sums it up. You know, it's terrible. But they should leave some things just well alone. There should be like a list, which I believe the Académie Française has. You know, they have banned names, they have banned various banned things, but including things you are not allowed to remake or try to adapt, which is actually quite a good idea, I think, in some cases. Just bloody leave it alone.
Well, it happens. Total Recall's another one that they redid, which is, for me, is probably one of my favourite Schwarzenegger sci-fi films at that period.
Oh, that's Verhoeven again, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember watching it and it just blew me away. We saw it in 1991 when it came out on the big screen, obviously, in those days. Yeah. Funnily enough, three friends and I had just come back from an alleged fishing trip to Ireland, which actually consisted of just drinking for like 3 days solidly.
Yes.
We didn't even take any fishing stuff with us, which was a bit of a giveaway, but there you go. And we came back all hungover and just sat there and watched it, and all of us just completely blown away by it. It was an amazing piece, wasn't it? Just so fab. Yeah, just absolutely brilliant. And I've watched it again actually quite recently, and it stands up.
Yeah,
it really does. It is paced so well, especially the Martian dreams and stuff like that.
It is. It's quite clever. It's not your usual, you know. And I like a film that you can watch and just watch things blow up for 2 hours now and again, Stu, like the next person. But Total Recall is a very different. It's a very cerebral action film.
It is. It is. It's well thought out, and it sort of sticks probably about until about halfway through to the original P.K. Dick novel, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
So it's like the basically it turns when he suddenly within his dream he has the psychiatrist stood in front of him saying blue pill red pill effectively, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, and he does that, and that's the real Philip K. Dick piece. And at that point, then after that, it goes a little bit off. But what I've always loved is the dream sequence when he starts looking at the reactor under Mars, under Olympus Mons. Because it's so redolent of Forbidden Planet, isn't it? It's exactly, it just completely sort of channels the Krell supercomputer under Altair 7, you know, when Morbius is trying to do the same thing, kind of, but his is going inside rather than going outside, which is what the one under Olympus Mons is doing. But that's just so well shot, and I remember seeing that, and it was just brilliant. It is so good, isn't it?
It is. Even, you know, that period where if you were having discussions with people who had also seen that film for probably the next 5 years, you'd just go, open your mind.
Yeah.
Open your mind.
Yeah, that was a Yeah, Wade, start the reactor. I remember somewhat chemically enhanced saying that to a friend about the microwave. We needed popcorn. We really needed popcorn. Start the reactor. free Northwest Bristol. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. There is so much going on, though, in this particular period, as we say. I mean, obviously, everybody concentrates on the big ones. Obviously, you've got the birth of the zombie at the end of the 60s and into the 70s.
Yeah.
You've got Hammer basically making the same film 15 times.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah,
Hammer better than most.
Hammer did some really weird stuff, didn't they? I mean, you know, do you think they made things like Steptoe and Sunride again? Yes. You know, and it's just all these things. They were just trying, jobbing, basically. Things. The thing is, Hammer can make really good films. And if you look at their sort of early colour stuff, you know, the black and white stuff kind of is quite standard 19, sort of, you know, mid-century British films, aren't they? And quite a lot of them aren't particularly horror films. They're thrillers, you know, and there's quite a lot of those. And there's a lot of sort of afternoon Channel 4 fillers on there sort of thing. But then they started making the colour ones. And the colour, and this is an interesting thing, because the colour has a very distinctive look. Hammer doesn't look like anything else. Mm. It's almost like it's watercolour to look at, isn't it? It's that very soft, kind of dreamy look to it. And this is something I'm going to come on to, because those same technicians that made Hammer and all the sets and all the costumes and everything were then used to make Carry On Screaming, which is why Carry On Screaming looks so bloody authentic. It's because it's a Hammer film.
Mm.
It just happens to be a Carry On film.
Yeah.
But there is a coincidence about this, about Hammer and about Carry On. And I'm not sure if you're aware of it, Paul.
No, right. I'm not.
Okay. So at the beginning of the 1960s, they were casting around to basically get the creature for the first Hammer Frankenstein film.
Yep.
They needed somebody who was over 6'5" in height. Okay. But they also needed somebody who was a good actor and actually relative, you know, who was known. They didn't want a complete unknown for it. So they went to all the casting agents in London and they whittled it down to two people. And that was Bernard Breslau and Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
The two of them, right?
Yeah.
So they said, well, how much is it going to cost? Now, Breslau, because at that time he was doing the army game and stuff like that, was going to cost them £15 a week. Whereas Christopher Lee was going, or £15 a day, rather. Whereas Christopher Lee was going to cost them £12 a day. So basically, by being cheaper than Bernard Breslau, Christopher Lee became the biggest star Hammer ever had. And imagine if it had gone the other way. Oh. Can you imagine Christopher Lee sat in a Morris Minor next to St. James? I only asked. You know, just see him in a polo neck sweater, like looking, you know, we're looking through binoculars at a bunch of girls camping. It would just be fabulous. And then I can imagine Bruno Breslau stood in front of Edward Wood, we're being burnt along.
And that's the very essence of the sliding doors moment.
Oh, so. Isn't it? Totally. But you know, it's just made. But then, funnily enough, you mentioned James Bond earlier on. There's of course Christopher Lee was part of the model for James Bond, because he actually was. I would say, but he was never cast as Bond himself because he was too big.
Yeah.
He was just too distinctive looking. They always said Bond has to be able just about to blend in.
Yes.
You know, he needs to be handsome, but you don't need somebody that big, that commanding. He just wouldn't work. Whereas in fact, in real life, he was very much one of the patterns for it, because Fleming knew him.
Yeah.
And it's all these amazing little like coincidences.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, again, coming back to the Carry On films, Carry On Spying, which is the James Bond film, a James Bond spoof, looks absolutely like a Bond film, again, because it's filmed at Pinewood on James Bond sets. They use the sets for Goldfinger for Carry On Spying.
Mm.
So it looks absolutely accurate, you know.
Yeah.
They're quite clever, actually. They use the Caron Cleos using the Cleopatra set.
Mm.
So they just went in and just like took the bit, which is ace. Like The Life of Brian using Jesus of Nazareth set, which is which is pretty ace as well. It's got to be said.
Absolutely. And I would imagine it's probably one of the reasons why Lee played Scaramanga in The Man with the Golden Gun as well.
Yeah, he always wanted to. And they sort of said, look, you've got to be a Bond villain, mate. You can't be Bond himself, but you can be one of the villains.
Yeah.
And he is absolutely tremendous, you know. But the Hammer look has become so ingrained in, you know, the watery sort of watercolour Look, and the way it's cut as well, the way it's performed, because it's quite stagey a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know, as British film tended to be, there's not a great deal of naturalism in there.
Mm.
But it continued. And I was thinking about this the other night, and the one that I remember the most, because I was exactly the right age to see it, was actually, if you think about it, The Phantom Raspberry Blur of Old London Town.
Yes,
which is a Hammer film. Yeah. it might have
two
been
Ronnies.
A Spike Milligan. And actually Ronnie Barker, agent was Ronnie Barker.
Yes.
So it's written by Milligan and Barker. But they made it as a Hammer film.
Yeah.
And it is completely a Hammer film. It's got, like, you know, the Prime Minister with a off we go and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's marvelous. I watched it again not long ago and it's just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
It's not a one joke thing. It goes on. It builds, yeah. You know, and obviously there's all the Jack Ripper stuff like that. More trivia. You like the trivia, don't you, Paul?
I do.
And thank God for that. It's going to be a very short conversation. One of my favourite facts, you know, when they trap him in the end in the sewer?
Yes.
Right. And he's like the sewer at either end. That sewer, and this is absolutely true, is directly under Riddington Place.
Oh.
So directly under where Christie's bloody outfall came, and whether they knew it or not, I don't know, but you've got to suspect they did. They thought this is an in joke.
Oh,
I know, wonderful, isn't it?
Goodness me, that is one of there are some strange things like that when it comes to, as we often wonder about, Stu, about the Fortean connection between things, for them to film that under such a notorious address, and obviously leads into another very famous, you know, series of films, and Christie's has become synonymous with probably one of the first sort of adaptations of a serial killer in modern cinema.
Yeah.
So it shows you sometimes that even for those of us who are more open-minded, it shows you just how many people have these weird hobbies that they think, we've got to film it here because of the history.
Yeah. And you do start to think about that, don't you? It's kind of, you know, again, you come back to the Amityville thing, funnily enough. And they you know, they wanted to film something actually at the Amityville house from Roddy. I'm only halfway through the documentary, so I don't know if they touched on this yet. But that's just, no, yeah, come on. Yep. All the haunting aside, or you know, whatever the extent of the haunting, and I've long believed, as I think most of us have, there was probably something happening, but it's not nearly obviously as exaggerated as they made out. But people were actually killed there.
Yes.
You know, it's a murder scene. Do you know that's quite an ethical question, isn't it? You know, you know, it's going, do you use the original? But then again, you say people, well, they filmed things in Rome and people were regularly stabbed in the street there. Do you do that? You know, it's an interesting debate, isn't it? I know.
Yeah. Well, Alan, it's one of those things, because it's become a property that's notorious. And I know one of the owners, I don't know if it's the current one, but one of the owners flatly refused. He even had the address changed because he was sick to death of people turning up.
Yeah.
Taking pictures and nicking bits of fence as they do
in
some of these locations.
Things become public property. I remember a children's author, I can't remember who it was, but she's up quite a remote place in Scotland. And because she set it in a local thing, people just rock up to her front door and think it's okay to have a chat. And she said, you've got to be polite, because obviously they're, you know, but it gets a bit wearing after. I imagine it bloody does get a bit wearing, you know, people driving 25 miles just to come and knock on your door. It must be a bit, you know.
Yes.
But something like that, particularly if there's feelings in there. You know, there's it was within people's memories, especially. It's a bit much, isn't it? But yeah, I know. But yeah, but anyway, back to the films, I suppose. It's kind of but Riddington Place, 10 Riddington Place. Yes, it was one of the first ones ever to show. Somebody said the banality of evil, wasn't it?
Yes.
Christie wasn't a bloke in a top hat, cackling, wringing his hands.
No,
he was an unregarded, bald bloke who very mild mannered, and actually he was. You know, it's an amazing performance. You forget how good an actor Attenborough was.
Yes,
he was a tremendously good actor and a brilliant director as well.
Yep.
You know, and it's interesting because at one point Spielberg wanted him to direct part of Schindler's List, but he couldn't do it. But he also wanted to do a bit of Jurassic Park, apparently. But he just declined. He said, "No, this is not my thing." You know, but Spielberg really wanted him to be in his film, sort of thing. So he got to play Hammond instead. You know.
Yeah, he's probably too busy trying to work out what accent he was doing in the film, I think.
Oh, lovely. I do love his accent.
Which one?
Well, exactly. Yeah, all of them. He's great. But there's a really interesting example. We're going to leap forwards back with Jurassic Park. Is actually quite a good one. There's a lot of interesting stuff about it. I mean, apart from anything else, as somebody said, you could just make them lions. It could be a normal animal film.
Yes.
Basically, you look at it that way, and the dinosaurs are only actually on the film for 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You get 10 minutes of that's all you get in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
The rest of it's all suggestion. But there was a really good documentary a while back about the making of it and how he basically made Jaws again. You see, he wanted, especially the Tyrannosaur, he wanted to make Jaws again. And there's lots of Jaws references. And this is the one I never noticed. But when they're in the Jeeps and the Tyrannosaurus's footsteps, you just get the bump, bump like that. It's actually a double beat. It's a bum, bum like that. And it follows exactly the same tune as Jaws.
Yep.
So it's da-dum. Yep. It's exactly da-dum. And it follows it. And he said, that's in the back of your mind. And he knew it. And all of these things and the pure craftsmanship of the film is absolutely fabulous. It's just brilliant, you know.
Mm.
And Spielberg's pretty good. We can come back to Spielberg. Yeah. But yeah, I suppose we better go back to the 1950s, really, haven't we?
Yeah. That's simple. Well, yeah. We could borrow a DeLorean and head back.
Absolutely. Oh, no, I'm not starting that one. That's just sci-fi. That's... Definitely. But I suppose for most of us, many of us, the heyday is kind of like the late 60s, early 70s, because that's films we would have seen, because obviously most of us, well, certainly I'm 57 now. So, I mean, I hit 13 in 1980.
Mm.
So that's when I got given a TV, my own little TV to watch. And a lot of these films were on at 11 o'clock at night on regional television.
Yeah.
So and there was only three channels, as we know, you know. I'm not going to go down the four Yorkshireman sketch. Much respect to yourself, my friend. There were anything. So you were basically stuck at what you want to watch, you know. Yeah. And if you didn't want to watch Newsnight, then right, you know, you'd watch. And that's when I first got to see them.
Mm.
And there were loads of them that I could never imagine in colour, because I'd only seen them on a really small screen.
Yeah.
And there was quite a lot of them made in the late 60s, which were a bit salacious, weren't there? Sort of like ones with Judy Geeson and stuff like that. And they used to show up quite regularly, to my gratification at that age. But then there was an awful lot of Hammer stuff, which I just kind of grew up watching. And one of the main one that stuck in my mind, because I remember it was on at New Year, about 1980. And that was Dr. Fibes.
Hey.
The Abominable Dr. Fibes. And I thought, oh, well, that sounds a bit crap, because I didn't know, you know. And I looked in the Radio Times. Was it Radio? Yeah, it had been Radio Times, because it was on BBC. And it said, all it said was, a concert musician takes revenge on people who killed his wife. And I said, oh, all right, we'll watch this. And I was just spellbound from the beginning.
Yeah.
Because I knew who Vincent Price was, but he was obviously in this mask, and he was quite disfigured. And that was, you know, but when you first see him, he's not, is he? He looks normal. Because he's wearing a mask.
Yep.
Sort of thing. And I was just like, where's this going? And I was like, oh, okay, lovely. And then basically he just starts murdering people in the most brilliant ways possible.
Yes.
And you sat there because they take it ever so seriously. This is the great thing about all of these, this cycle particularly, there's so many of them with Vincent Price, is he plays it straight.
Yep.
He does not camp it up. He completely plays it straight in the same way as Leslie Nielsen used to in Airplane.
Yep.
He is the funniest man on earth because he's playing it as a normal part.
Yep.
That's it. So fun. So, I mean, you know, so he's trying to. So basically, I mean, the story is, for people who haven't seen it, and you haven't seen it, I really, really, really urge you to do it. So he's basically, I mean, if you look at the premise for a start, he's a concert organist, and he's got a doctorate in both music and theology.
Yep.
Because obviously.
Why not?
And people thought he died in a car crash on the continent in the early 20s, basically because his wife had died.
Yes.
And he was racing home to try and get to her. And she died during surgery. But actually, he survived. He was badly burnt, and he can't speak. He'd lost his vocal cords, so he couldn't speak. But basically, he, with his genius for music and theology, he also managed to remake his face with prosthetics himself.
Yes.
And then used his knowledge of acoustics to give himself a voice.
Yep.
Obviously. And then basically he basically reappears in London in 1925 and starts murdering the doctors. And it's got, okay, so the murders are predicated on the something called the Ten Plagues of Egypt.
Yes.
Which there weren't ten plagues of Egypt, but never mind. For the purposes of this, there were ten plagues of Egypt. And they're brilliant. Some of them, I mean, basically filling a room with vampire bats while someone's asleep. Put in a frog, because these are all supposed to all reflect these plagues. So bats, right, okay. The frog head mask. So basically, somebody has to put a frog head on their
clockwork frog, head.
Frog mask on their head, yeah, don't they? and then it gradually tightens until it crushes their head and kills them.
Yeah.
Terry Thomas, who's fabulous. I mean, I love. I can watch Terry Thomas all day. They basically drain his body of blood while he sat there. Yeah. He just gets paler and paler, doesn't he?
Yeah, whilst watching a naughty film.
Whilst watching a naughty film, yes. I mean, this is, absolutely. Imagine being found like that, honestly. God, blimey. You know, we've had him completely drained of blood and his trousers around his ankle. Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, then they freeze someone to death by pumping their car full of snow.
Yes.
Why didn't they get out? It's just like, no. Yeah. Rats on a plane. There's no Samuel L. Jackson, but there's rats on a plane.
Yeah.
My favourite of the lot, a giant metal unicorn fired from a catapult.
Yeah. Well, the best thing about that scene is after he's been killed is that they're trying to unscrew him, aren't they? And you can see his legs and his head going round. And they're going, the other way. It's anti-clockwise.
I know, it's absolutely fabulous.
It's brilliant. It's one of those films, Stu, that I hadn't seen. I knew about Fibes a long time before I'd actually seen it, because I got a book about horror films, Alan Frank's Encyclopedia of Horror, when I was about 6 or 7. My mum got it for me from Woolworths. And so I'd seen that image of him in Skull at the organ. I thought, whoa, this looks amazing. So I don't think I saw Fibes till probably around the same time you're talking about, early 80s. And then I didn't realise there was a sequel for about 10 years. And the sequel's even stranger.
The sequel is bloody marvellous.
Because there's a lot of strange things about that, because obviously when he made it, they were trying, from what I gather, there was a lot of problems on set between Price and Quarry. Price just didn't like him at all. And I think the studio had kind of said to Quarry they were going to make him the star of the third one for whatever reason. Until Price found out, and then they rewrote it hurriedly to kill him off in it.
Yeah.
But there is one other thing about both of these films that I've never understood, and I've never even heard her explain why, is the fact that Fibes' wife is the beautiful Caroline Munro, who is in both films as his wife, and is completely uncredited in both of them.
Yes, that's right. She doesn't speak, does she?
Well, I don't know, because she's the key reason he's doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
In both films. And, you know, she was a star at this point. She'd already appeared in a Dracula film. She started doing more Hammer films, because she ended up doing Captain Kronos.
She did.
Which was another
Vampire
one.
Hunter.
Yeah, which is another underrated one, I think. It's one of them that, when you finally see it, you think, hang on, why did I not know about this one?
Absolutely.
She became a Bond girl. She was in the Sinbad film.
She was.
She made one of the worst films ever, which was a rip-off of Star Wars, which is Star Crashers.
Oh, I've never seen that one.
Oh, right. If you want to see a genuinely hilarious version of Star Wars that was made with all seriousness, then Star Crashers is it, because it's just barmy. None of it makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, the robots talks in a Texan accent to start. And it's just, it's one of those rash of sci-fi films we got in the late 70s where they just go, oh my God, Star Wars is the biggest film in the world. Make me something like that.
Yeah. Well, was it Roger Corman himself made Battle Beyond the Stars?
Yes, with John Boy from Walters.
With John Boy and Sybil Danning. At that age, I noticed Sybil Danning rather more than anybody else. But it was and Robert Vaughn, one of the actual original Magnificent Seven in the Magnificent Seven in Space.
Yes,
and
essentially.
It's just brilliant. And I watched it, and it's just such a cheerful film, isn't it? You know, it just makes no pretension. But I've always liked that about Roger Corman. There's no pretension about it. He's doing what he's doing, and take him or leave him. And that's a wonderful thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's another one. You look back, as we were talking about Price and Fibes.
Yeah.
Obviously, Price and Corman had that wonderful series of films where they made six or seven films, very quick succession in the early 60s, two of whom are my absolute favourites, because The Mask of the Red Death,
I think, is
one of the most beautiful films to watch.
It is. It's when the two of them work together and they took it seriously, they could. I mean, Corman can make films. You know, he properly can.
Yeah.
And he sticks. He's very, very true to the source material as well, isn't he? You know, all the stuff that he would post of that, and you know, Pit and the Pendulum, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He's very, very, very reverent towards the source, and they don't muck around with it, and it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. House of Usher is another one.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's, and they're really good. But as a result, that kind of gave them the pedigree, didn't it? To if they wanted to fool around a bit, they could.
Yeah.
You know, and it's And then I mean, but you know, back to I mean, Price just absolutely walks away with it, doesn't he? Even though he's under a mask and he's not even speaking. Mm. It's coming through a speaker, isn't it? Because he can't speak anymore.
Yes.
But he's got things like his clock. You know, his clockwork orchestra.
Yeah.
He's got a Hammond organ. That's my favourite detail of the lot. He's got a Hammond organ that raises up out of the floor like at a cinema.
Yeah.
You know, and he's wearing his cape.
Yeah. I mean, it looks beautiful as well because it's all Art Deco.
It's beautiful. Absolutely Art Deco. It's absolutely gorgeous. And then that was sort of such a success. But as you said, they immediately went off and made it again with Dr. Fibes Rises again. Mm. And they even bring Terry Thomas back as somebody else.
Yeah.
It's still Terry Thomas. Like,
couple of guest stars in it as well. Peter Cushing turns up in the sequel.
He does, yeah, absolutely. John Thorpe, a young John Thorpe, who, if I remember rightly, gets basically put in a giant vice.
John Thorpe gets attacked by an eagle that pecks his eyes out.
Oh, God, that's right. Who is it gets put in the giant vice? It's something like a camp bed, isn't it? And they get basically
concertina.
Somebody else gets put in a giant bottle. I remember that, and thrown over.
Yeah, he's the one that turns the machine on the boat. And, that's it. Somebody says, did he like a drink? Pike.
Yeah. Somebody else gets sandblasted to death, don't they? And, you know.
Yes.
And all these things. And then the police, who could possibly be doing this? It's like, are you looking at these murders, mate? Who do you think it was? And then they hear that they've got a clockwork orchestra. Then he's like, oh, it might be Dr. Fibes. But it's fabulous. Yeah. I just bloody love it. It's marvellous. And then it finishes, funny enough, as we mentioned earlier, with him going off down the river of life, doesn't he? With her body to somewhere over the rainbow.
Yes.
Just absolutely magnificent.
Yes, with his assistant, Volnavia.
Volnavia, or Volvania.
Dancing off down that mirrored tunnel, and everybody's like, what's going on here?
Oh, absolutely. But the influences of that kind of film, they kind of gave license to people to say, actually, you can have fun with it.
Yes.
You can muck around with it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and again, we come, you know, Sam Raimi sort of really, really credited it with Darkman. He said Darkman is effectively Dr. Fibes again.
Yes.
You know, when you watch Darkman, it's just brilliant. I watched it a couple of years ago for the first time in ages. And it's fabulous.
Mm.
It's so funny. And Liam Neeson, you forget, he's actually a really good comedian.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, it really, really works, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's him with his face and all that kind of stuff. But the initial bit where he blows up and this little figure goes flying out of a window.
Yeah.
That's just pure vibes. And that's just a wonderful, wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and it's brilliant. But it's had lots of, you know, you can have fun with these things. You know,
absolutely.
Obviously. And Scream and stuff like that shows that.
Yeah, of course it can. I mean, you've got to be able to have... I mean, that's the thing about the Fives film is, in the first one, Price is playing it completely straight and everybody else is doing the comedy. But in his little things he does, like when the guy gets eaten by the rats in the plane and it crashes, and he's watching with the telescope, and as it happens, he just drops the telescope like mic drop.
Yeah.
Boom. Or in the second one where she's made him some fish.
Yes.
And he gets a bone stuck in. And he starts coughing, and then he has to reach around to his special orifice in the back of his head to pull the fishbone out, and he just smiles at her, and they carry on eating.
God, I know. But I mean, yeah, but on the back of that, of course, after Fibes, going back to Price, then they did my favourite of the lot, which is Theatre of Blood.
Brilliant.
Which absolutely takes Fibes, but then just takes it in a completely new way, doesn't it? So it's got, you know, you've got the great Shakespearean actor who was wronged with Diana Rigg as his daughter, and Diana Rigg, fabulous, she's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
and he's taking revenge on all the critics.
Yeah,
said the critic. He's taking revenge on all the critics.
Yes, be careful, Stu.
I'm being careful. I've got, yeah. Well, I think Dr. Sutton only gets about two or three complaint letters about me at the moment, which is quite good. So I'm clearly doing something right.
Good.
There have been more in the past.
But it's very similar. There is a lot of vibes in that.
There is.
When it comes, because you see how he takes his revenge on people. There are a couple that people remember very well, I think, more than some. Michael Holden's obviously the first one who gets killed by a group of drunk tramps in the warehouse. But obviously you've got Robert Morley being fed his own poodles in a pie.
Yeah, from Coriolanus, he gets fed his own children.
And then you've got the hairdresser. Hi, I'm Butch. The hairdresser.
That's just wonderful.
Vincent Price in a bubble perm.
In a wig. And dark glasses. And it's just so obviously her, but they just go with it, you know. And it's fabulous. And then you got Arthur Lohan, his head sawed off while his wife's asleep next to him. Yes. And put his head on a milk bottle. It's fabulous. But my favourite bit of the lot is him and Ian Hendry having a duel on trampolines.
Yeah, sword fight.
Swords just leaping around. But you look, when you watch that film, you look at the look on their faces and they are enjoying every second of it.
Oh,
both
yes.
of them are just absolutely having a blast. Yes. It's a fabulous film. I mean, you haven't seen Theatre of Blood, honestly, you can get the DVD for like £1.50 from Amazon or stream it. It's probably on one of the streaming services.
Yeah, it's on Prime.
Say what?
It's on Prime.
It's on Prime. Watch it. You will not regret it if you haven't seen Theatre of Blood. Yeah. It is an absolute bloody hoot.
Yep.
And it's just wonderful. Yeah. And I love it. Yeah.
I think he's, when they talk about eras, a lot of people in that particular era concentrate on Cushing and Lee. And I think if you look at what Price did throughout the 60s and the early 70s, he probably made more films that have stood the test of time is all the ones we've mentioned. You've got the Corman films. He did The Last Man on Earth.
He did. Which is that he was about the... Was he the first one to make it?
Yes, that's the first version.
That's the first one, because The Omega Man was the second one.
Yep.
And then Will Smith.
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend. No, it's the bloke's called Neville, you see. We're immortal. You can't kill us. You know, his name's Richard Neville. Great bloke, you know. But I must admit, I quite like what they did at the end of I Am Legend. I mean, basically making him the monster was a clever move. Spoiler alert, sorry, people, if you haven't seen it. But I mean, once something's been out for 10 years, I think you can discuss the ending, to be honest. But he did. Price was capable of extremely good acting. I mean, in Witchfinder General, he is genuinely chilling, isn't he?
Yes.
He has that because he has that quiet mania. But it's the same with Peter Cushing could do the same thing.
Yes.
Peter Cushing was frightening because he was a nice, precise man, you know, and that's the thing. And that's what makes him so creepy. And because, you know, this is something we can come on to, because then in the 70s, after when TV started becoming bigger than films, then you start getting things like Hammer House of Horror.
Yeah.
You know, in which the most famous one probably is the one with Peter Cushing as a associate pet shop owner. But actually, you know, it's a really... When I was a kid, I watched it. I don't know, that's not very good. But watching it later as an adult, you see that actually that's a frightening bloody thing. A very young Brian Cox in it as well, isn't it? You know, it's an absolute tour de force.
Yeah.
Just as this, I'm not going to give it away because I think people need to see this because it's kind of forgotten. But if you do try and find Hammer House of Horror, the one with Brian Cox and Peter Cushing in it, because it doesn't go where you think it's going to go at all, does it?
Mm.
It just like it, you know, it's just, you it kind of, with almost with horror, you start to, literally horror, you start to realise where it's going. And then the final payoff is just absolutely fabulous.
I'm trying to think. You see, the thing about the Hammer House of Horror, Stu, is it's one of those that I've been meaning to rewatch it all again. And I've never got round to it.
Ah.
And there's only one episode that has stuck in my mind. And there's probably loads, and I just can't. I'm not placing it with the right show, or I'm thinking of Tales of the Unexpected or something.
Yeah.
But there's one episode that has always stuck with me forever, and it made me feel, it's one of those when you watch something and you love horror films and drama, you know, chilling dramas and things like that, and it just left me feeling empty afterwards. I didn't know how to feel about it, which was quite an odd sensation. And the only thing I remember about it really is that a couple are trapped in a house that's in the middle of nowhere. There's motorways on either side.
That's it. That's the one with Peter Cushing. And that is the one. Basically, he's trapped them.
I completely forgot Cushing and Cox are in that. I just remember the setup and what the payoff is afterwards.
That's the payoff. It's basically, you know, he turns out he was a a concentration camp guard.
Yes.
You know, and he's basically trapped them in this house. But then they manage to kill him, not realizing that that means they can't get out either.
Yes.
and it's kind of this oh, it's quite frightening, actually. Yeah. And some of the other ones are quite jolly. There's Children of the Moon, which Diana adores, about werewolves. And yeah, that's a good one. Because it's got a lot of jump cuts in it. Because you're kind of waiting for stuff to happen, which then does happen. Mm. There's one of it's not called Twins of Evil. It's something of evil. And it's weird village and stuff like that. And there's quite a few standard ones, but they're actually all quite good. They work. They then decided to make Hammer House of Mystery and Suspense, which just didn't work quite as well at all. Because they were just ordinary thrillers, really. And they weren't that thrilling. You know, so no, but first series of Hammer House of Horror, yeah, definitely give it a go. It's some pretty good stuff in there. Mm. And around that same time, just before that, rather, there was Armchair Thriller as well,
yeah,
which went for quite a long time. But there's one, of course, episode that everybody remembers, and it's kind of become a touchstone for you know, all the hauntology stuff. And that was Quiet as a Nun.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. We watched, you know, that was on, I'll tell you exactly when that was on. That was on in April 1978. And I know it was on April 1978 because it was a week before our whole school year went on a trip to Cornwall where we stayed in an old convent that had just become a hotel. And so we'd seen this thing with this ghostly nun and things and shadows on the wall and gone as well. And these poor bloody teachers had to take sort of 20 11-year-olds to that kind of environment for a week. Jesus, mate, it was like Vietnam. We all needed something. It was terrible. It was all, but it was so frightening because there was this, there was basically the sequence we all remember, isn't it? It was just basically a nun with no face.
Yes.
It just frightened the bloody life out. It was a nun, but she'd have a fat, and it just frightened the bloody life out of me. And I slept with the light on that night, which I admit I sometimes have to do, but you know, especially after reading communion on my own that night, that was a stupid thing to do. But it was amazing. But none of them ever lived up. That was the first series, but they never lived up to it after that, unfortunately. But that one, that Quiet of a Nun, as a nun, that whole that one series was well worth it. You know, and it traumatized a whole generation of kids, me included. You know, it's quite an amazing thing. And then, but there was loads they made for kids as well, wasn't there? Directly, like sort of. I'll tell you one that sticks in my mind. They did two attempts at Stig of the Dump.
Don't
you remember this? Yeah, they had two. Basically, they had one where it's just like an ordinary looking, good looking teenage lad in a fur coat with a bit of mud on his face. But then they did one who looked like an ape. Properly.
I don't remember the second one. I remember watching the first one when I was at school.
There was this little sort of trend for doing this because there was two series on roughly the same time, which was Chimera, which was a Sunday night thriller. It only ran to one series, but it was basically a half human, half baboon hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried smuggled it out of a secret lab in Portendown or whatever, and were trying to get it to somewhere that they could expose what was happening. That was quite good. And then there was also the Gore Saga at the same time. The Gore Saga, which a young Charles Dance,
yes,
which is again a human gorilla hybrid, wasn't it?
Mm.
And it was based on a series of books. But that was a really good one. That worked quite well. And the BBC used to make these things quite regularly.
Yeah.
They made Nightmare Man as well.
Yes.
Do you remember Nightmare Man? The Nightmare Man was absolutely amazing. You know, that was a tremendous piece of work. You know, and it's never been repeated. I think you can get it on DVD now, or you can probably stream it.
Mm.
But it is absolutely marvellous.
Yeah, it is strange how they've gone away from doing that for so long. Because, you know, as you've mentioned a couple of times in this, I wasn't aware of this Amityville thing, because as soon as I see the word Amityville, my brain shuts down and I move on to something interesting.
Yes.
Usually.
Yeah, I agree. I was all Amityville out completely. Yeah.
And I thought, because of how successful Uncanny has been, and you could also say that Ghosts has been a massive success for them.
Oh, God, it has. Yeah, totally.
That they seem to have rediscovered the paranormal after ignoring it for probably the best... Well, probably, you would say, since Ghost Watch. They've not touched it. They've not really done any kind of shows about it. They've kind of left it. Like, whenever they've kind of touched on the paranormal in Doctor Who, they're always aliens, really.
Mm.
And so for them to suddenly be reinvigorated through podcasts and comedy about the supernatural, because I know you've got Mark Gatiss's Ghost Stories for Christmas, which are of a varying quality. I have to say, I found the last one deeply annoyed me because they completely changed the ending.
Yes.
And I just thought, what is the point of adapting something and then changing the complete ending? It just doesn't make sense. Why adapt something to change the ending? Either write your own stuff or leave something alone, because it completely changes the context of that story.
You're exactly right. That's the thing. It's, you know, they are perfectly, especially M.R. James and stuff like that, is perfectly written.
Yeah.
They are absolutely brilliant examples of the art.
Mm.
Adapting stories is difficult for the screen. I absolutely agree. You've got to, you know, a short story will take you, you know, half an hour to read, where they've got to make it to an hour on the screen. That's tricky. I mean, I remember because, mainstream, but Brideshead Revisited, John Mortimer said the problem with Brideshead Revisited is there's no dialogue in the book. And basically, so you're trying to create the dialogue out of what's basically descriptive prose.
Yes.
You know, but it's much the same, but there's very little dialogue in M.R. James.
Mm.
You know, so you're basically trying to invent dialogue to reflect what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's a tricky thing to do. You could make them silently, effectively.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not surprised Dan tried that. But I did think the Metzler Tim was pretty good. But I think that him, particularly when he's working with Rory Kinnear, they're slightly better when they're doing more roustabout stuff. If you've ever seen their version of The First Men on the Moon.
Yes.
That
very good.
Is brilliant. That just absolutely rollocks along, doesn't it? It's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, I liked his original one he did a couple of years earlier, The Dead Zone.
Yes.
With Simon Callow. Because Simon Callow, you can basically just put him in front of a camera for 30 minutes and he's amazing.
Oh,
and I really like that, even though it became very obvious after about 10 minutes where we were going with this. I still really liked it. I get frustrated that when you take something like that that's probably never been shown on the TV, because a lot of people, I remember when it was shown, people going, oh, I can't believe he's done this to an M.R. James film. It's an Arthur Conan Doyle story for a start. To take something like that that's probably never been dramatised on television before. And change the end. It's just, I just don't understand it, Stu.
No. You don't take a diamond and then break it up into little diamonds.
No.
You know what I mean? That's not the way you do it. You mount it properly.
Strangely enough, as we were talking at the beginning, remembering people called Kit, then you should use the characters and the storyline you've got rather than just try and adapt it. And you just kind of think, when everything else seems to be going so well, like I said, I'm really surprised that they've gone into the paranormal documentary series with Amityville. Maybe it's because, as many people who don't have a real interest in this, Stu, and they, if you ask them about the paranormal, they'll mention Amityville. I don't know. But as soon as I saw it, I just thought, well, why are we starting here if this is where the direction we're going to go?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, this documentary, I must admit, is looking at the whole thing. If you imagine it's an Adam Curtis documentary series, and it's looking at the thing in the round, and it does it very cleverly. It's taken the different elements of it. So it's taken the legend. It's taken the actual crime. It's taken the media treatment of it. And then it's doing the conclusion as to what has informed what.
Yeah.
And it's done it brilliantly. It's really good. As I said, imagine Adam Curtis did it. It's that good.
Right.
And I totally, totally recommend it because, yeah, I was completely sick to death of bloody Amityville. I'd just had enough of it. You know what I mean? It had been, I don't know, it's just so overexposed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I do sometimes worry that perhaps this is the way Enfield's going to go because they kind of left it alone for a while, but then it's suddenly come right back, hasn't it?
Yes.
And it's become this massive, massive thing. And you think, you know, is it, are they going to start to come? The Conjuring started buggering about with it, didn't it? And that's one of the things that kicked it back off again.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's you're diluting it more and more. That's the problem. People extrapolate stuff and then they'll look at it. And the problem is, especially if they're making a dramatization, they'll think, well, we've got to make this a bit more interesting. Mm. And it's always been, of course, as you know, my main criticism of ghost hunting programs, again, is quite often it's obvious that, because I've been on ghost hunts, you know, they're boring. Most of the time you're sat there in silence in the dark and nothing happens.
Mm.
And the problem is people don't want to see an hour of nothing. So they have to kind of spice it up, you know. And I think what you need something which will actually reflect the sporadic nature of these kind of things.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it gives a false impression, if nothing else. And therefore, people turn up on a ghost hunt and get bored very quickly when really, if anything happens, it's a remarkable occurrence. That's what makes the phenomenon so interesting, is that it is so sporadic. It's not on demand.
No, exactly. It's not. Things just, you know, You can't predict it. And this is the thing, you know, it's a bit like somebody said, it's very like when the TV man comes to repair your TV and suddenly it's working perfectly, you know, and then the moment they bugger off it goes again, whatever was wrong with it. It's the same sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially with poltergeists, because which does tend to suggest that there is a degree of sort of like reflexive control in there.
Yes.
The fact that they quite often will not perform if there's anyone else there.
Yeah.
You know, or they'll do something, but they'll do it so subtly, you know. But this is another discussion, because, I mean, there was a chat a while back in one of the ASAP meetings about whether or not we just register basically all kinds of phenomena. We just don't notice them. They're so small or so fleeting, we just don't recognise that they've happened.
Yeah.
You know, somebody said, it was a bit of a sort of a funny thought, but somebody said, well, you know, right, you can find your keys the other day. Perhaps something else moved them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you thought, oh, I'm sure I put them down there. Well, perhaps you did. You know, is that kind of thought? Hang on, wait a minute. You know, there's stuff happening all the time and we just don't twig it. It's like there's people see UFOs. People don't bloody look up.
Hmm?
There's people, there's things living in the woods. Yeah, but how many people are in the woods?
Well, yeah.
You know, it's all this kind of stuff. You know, it's like, nobody's seen anything in Loch Ness. Yeah, it's fucking dark in Loch Ness and it's enormous.
It is.
You know?
It's 21 miles long.
Exactly. You know, if you're in a rowing boat in the middle of the thing at night, well, you might spot something. You never know.
I mean, if you're lucky on a good day, you can just about see the other end of it from one end. Having been there myself, you can only just. And it takes you a while because I've been out on Loch Ness as well. You've got to be going for at least 2 or 3 miles before you can even see the furthest point north.
Oh, God, yeah.
So
it slightly bends. I know it does, but it does slightly bend.
Yeah, it does. And like I say, it's in Scotland. It's all dependent on the weather. Most of the time it's overcast. You can't see a bloody thing. It's tipping it down.
Yeah.
The water's pitch black.
It is. I mean, it's full of peat, isn't it? And it's kind of like, you know, it's... Yeah, I'm not. We can rationalise and we can sort of say there is probably, there might be something in there. And I think Rich Freeman's got a point when he says perhaps it's a giant eel or something like that.
Yeah.
Something which would live in there. And it's just big, or a big pike. You know, it could be, but it's big enough to come. It's not a plesiosaur. We know there's not a plesiosaur in there. That's fine. But who knows? Also, you know, that big eels can basically lie along the bottom. You won't see them.
Yeah.
You know, they're cold-blooded.
Come out on shore as well, Stu, which would explain some of the earlier sightings.
No, totally, totally. You know, so it could well be. And I think, but this comes back to it, doesn't it? I think this is the thing. You know, it's there could be all kinds of stuff happening. And I think, but you're right, people want to see fireworks.
Mm.
You know, and basically, if they don't see fireworks or hear fireworks, then they think, well, that's a bit crap then, and they're not going to watch it.
Mm.
Whereas I would find one really, I'm sure we've spoken about this before, haven't we? One of the most freaky things I ever heard it happened to me in the FT was about 15 years ago, 20 years ago actually. And this woman wrote in, and they'd basically gone to bed, they'd come downstairs, and all of the tins had been taken out of the cupboard and were arranged like Stonehenge as a circle in the middle of the kitchen floor.
Yeah.
And she said it never happened again, happened once. And that freaks me out. That's kind of, my God, that would worry me more than stuff that you kind of got used to happening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Once you've got it, because I know people live in haunted houses and they're just used to it. It's just like, okay, you zone it out, you know. We live really close to an airport. You don't hear planes after a while.
You know?
That's basically it.
Yeah.
So, I think you're right. It's unreasonable expectations, isn't it? That's what they give people.
Of course it is.
Shows,
you know. And the human brain can tune anything out. Like you refer to about being in a flight path, Stu.
Yeah.
The main southern entrance to Sheffield's train service runs at the bottom of my road.
Ah, right, okay.
I probably hear 2-3 trains a day, but I know there's probably 600-700 go through there.
Blimey, yeah. Yeah, but again, you don't hear. My mum used to live quite close to a railway station. You're right, you do... It's there. If you listen for it, you'll hear it.
Yes.
But you don't listen for it because it's just what it is, you know.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, the other aspect, as you were saying about some of these series, is some of them just have become so well known, and yet I think hardly anybody's seen. Kolchak is another one.
Oh, the Night Stalker.
And strange against you. It's only something I've been made aware of and seen since I started doing this show. You can't find that for love nor money in this country.
No, considering how much of a legend it is and everybody knows about it, you know, It's just absolute, you know, you'd think. And it used to be shown on ITV quite regularly.
Yeah.
At one point, you know. And yet you can get all this really, really obscure stuff. But that, no, you're right. You can't get it. And I'd love to see Kolchak again.
Yeah.
You know, because it informed so much stuff. It informed not just X-Files, which obviously is one of its main things. Yes. But things like Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
They all came out of Kolchak.
Yeah.
And it's very, very embedded in the American psyche.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was some rascal who put about 25 episodes on YouTube a couple of years ago. So I managed to see the three TV movie ones before somebody obviously flagged it for copyright and they all got wiped, which is really annoying. but yeah. It just showed, as we were showing about remakes and things like that, it makes you wonder, with all the stuff that we've had, Supernatural series television over the last 20 years has exploded on all platforms, all networks in North America and Europe. There are shows galore. Supernatural is a prime example of it. Grimm.
Yeah.
The X-Files coming back again. And yet, Kolchak, it's still there, stuck in 1975, and nobody seems to want to go back there because it's a prime example of a hard-hitting reporter investigating strange phenomenon.
Yeah, it is. And it's the sort of, and it's an evergreen thing, and it's really well made as well. You can watch it. It's funny, I've watched quite a lot of 70s TV. You watch something like an episode of the well-written ones, the good ones, which, is, for example, things like, not Kolchak, but Kojak, they're all really well made. They're actually very good. They're very watchable.
Yes.
You know, there was a lot of care put into them.
Yeah.
You know, they're not bubblegummy. They are, they've got the right balance of kind of like humour, but also, you know, intrigue and stuff like that. They're actually really, really well made. And it's, you know, and I think Kolchak would stand up fabulously. Mm. And there's people waving a flag for him, but, you know, I suppose it's ultimately, it comes down to whether or not, there might perhaps there's a rights issue or something like that, which is causing it, you know, which is often the way, or somebody might have bought Kolchak.
Yeah.
You know, they might have bought it and then you can't, you know, that nobody else is allowed to make it. Because this obviously happened with the Fantastic Four, didn't it? It was basically bought for, never going to be made. They just didn't want anybody else to make it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Fox did that with the X-Men.
They did.
They had a limit on it and they had to make a certain film. They had to release a film in a certain date to keep the rights rolling. I mean, it didn't matter in the end anyway, because the behemoth that is now Disney just ate them up anyway in the end. I think they probably did that just out of spite. I think because they kept making these films to keep the copyright, they went, "Nah, well, if we can't get them off you, we'll just buy you."
Exactly.
Which is one of those things. But there are these things that seem to have been lost from that particular era again. It's like when we used to have portmanteau films.
Yes.
And there aren't many of them. I know, you know, in recent years, people have gone about the VHS series of films, which I watched the first one. Two of them are really good. The rest are dreadful. But you had some absolute belters in the 60s and 70s. One of my favourites, even though it's slightly out of it, is The Monster Club, which once again features Vincent Price.
That's it. They've got that huge mural on the wall and they're pointing out the different varieties, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's the one, yeah. That's a half zombie, half werewolf. It's called Zomwolf or something like that. It's brilliant, isn't it?
It's about that guy who basically is being fleeced, and if he gets upset, he whistles, and he'll whistle in such a way that you become disfigured.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
And the village of flesh-eating cannibals living in rural Essex.
Yes, that's right. It's Basildon now, isn't it? I think pretty much.
And the vampire who lives in Suburbiton.
Yes, I know, it's just fabulous. It just gives them a kind of, and that, of course, then you start looking at What We Do in the Shadows and stuff like that.
Yeah,
which is kind of very, very similar, you know, and Being Human, which they filmed very close to me. Yeah. But that, you know, they're tremendous series actually, and I don't like the American. I hate to say it, but the American versions of Being Human, Ghosts, and What We Do in the Shadows just aren't quite the same. They're too glossy.
Mm.
They should be a little bit more downbeat, I think. That's part of the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ghosts has got a core of, I mean, no, BBC Ghosts has got a core actually quite melancholy a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It's quite sad.
It is. I mean, it's hidden. There's a dark humour to it. It's like the character who's his time wandering about without his trousers on.
Yeah. Yeah, and, the Tory MP.
Yeah, and he's always going on about, in the first few episodes, he's always going on about his legacy and how he'll be remembered, not realising. And then he eventually works out how that scene where he's trying to force himself to use Google.
Yes.
And then he realises that everybody remembers him as being that scandal sex scandal MP being caught, found dead without his trousers on.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, sometimes it's best just not to ask.
Or the Scoutmaster, how he dies. There's a darkness to it, even though it's a comedy film and it's quite sweet in bits. There are some real gut-punching bits about the ghosts.
There are, because it's smart enough. You know, that's the thing. It understands that you do have to have the dark in order to see the light, you know, and I think that's it. And it's something the BBC is very good at. And in fact, British scriptwriters are extremely good at it. American scriptwriters are getting better at it, I think. Mm. But it's still something the British do really well, because we do it. There's a really good podcast, I don't know if you've ever heard it, called Rule of Three, about comedy writing, actually.
Yeah.
But it with Jason Hazley and Joel Morris, who are really successful comedy writers. Mm. But they say, basically, the difference is the British have to do stuff on very much a much more restricted budget, but also on restricted time. The American studios can throw huge resources. That's why you've got 50 writers for a show.
Yeah.
You know, and they can afford that. You get two, he said, because that's it. He said, that's what you can do. And you learn to make do, but it makes you more ingenious. You actually do have to invest very much more in the series. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's been like the war. Somebody said, it's Al Murray, actually, you know, Al Murray, the pub landlord.
Yeah.
He said, look at the war effort. He said, this was reflected in the war effort. He said, basically, the Americans built Los Alamos. They built an entire town in the desert in order to service Manhattan Project. Yeah. He said, the British would get a load of professors from Imperial College into a vicarage in Suffolk. He said, that's what they did. He said, that's what we did. They built an entire city. We got a load of people in a house and got them to suck on pipes and go, well, what do we do about this then, Hargreaves?
Yeah, have a committee meeting.
Exactly. He said, but we still end up with a bouncing bomb.
Yeah.
You know, and of course we were part of the Manhattan Project, you know. Yeah. So I know.
Yeah.
How did we get here, Paul? We've done it again.
We do indeed. I mean, is there anything before you disappear, Stu? Is there anything from that particular period that you think people need to be aware of or look out for that, as we were saying, some of these films are very well known. I mean, you know, we've mentioned Night of the Living Dead and things like that.
Yeah.
Carrie, Rosemary's Baby, The Haunting.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, as I said at the beginning, you've got the program. You've got films like The House on Marsh Road, which is virtually unknown.
Do you know what? Of all the ones we talked about tonight, I think probably The Ghost of Mrs. Muir.
Yeah.
Because people just haven't seen it, and it's an absolutely beautiful film.
Yes.
And it's brilliant, and it's witty, and And it does. It gets you. Matter of Life and Death. The Haunting. Yes, always watch The Haunting, because if you want to see the most frightening film you've ever seen, it is The Haunting.
Yes.
Because you see nothing.
Absolutely.
Everything is implied. Yeah. And your mind is the most powerful and scary thing in the world. Yeah. Well, mine is at any rate, I must admit.
Absolutely. And if you get into them, then you might end up watching some Mario Bava, and that's a completely different kettle of fish.
Let's not go there, mate.
I still remember the one that always terrified me before you go, the Barbers from that period, is the one with where she nicks that ring off that old woman.
Oh god, yes, that's just like, oh good god. It's just that, yeah, that's the human beings being base is the most frightening thing of the lot, because it could happen to anybody, couldn't it?
Yeah, temptation, you
know? totally. And people, mate. No, awful.
Absolutely. Well, Stu, where can everybody read your musings on a regular basis? And
I'm still on the 40-hour forums. I haven't been on there very much at all recently, I must admit. Mm-hmm. I'm still like co-proprietoring that with Gordon Rutter. I got my monthly column in the FT, but I am writing more and more sort of like larger articles. And I am updating my own website, so I'll send you the address for that. I had loads of stuff like on storage, and I'm just gradually transferring it all onto the site. So, but it's not just my 40 musings. It's got my my urban magical realism, the rubbish that you read up from me on Facebook many a day, you know.
Yes.
Weird accidents and stuff like that, and quite a lot of my reviews. So I'm back. I can publish my reviews after 6 months.
Yes.
So I'm backfilling with the reviews as well.
Excellent. So any tempting morsels coming up in your column?
The Amityville will be the next one. I'm kind of on catch up at the moment. So as I said, my Ghostly Footsteps is going to be in the March issue, and then it'll be Amityville in April, and that's going to be a big one, because it is really significant, and I urge people to watch it.
Yes. Well, I'm going to give it a go, Stu, because the thing that shocked me about that is that I've seen so many people whose opinion I respect raving about it over the last few days that my initial feeling when I saw it has now turned to intrigue, because I'm wondering why so many people finding this so exciting. So I'm certainly going to give it a go, and even more so on your recommendation as well.
You won't be disappointed, my friend.
Brilliant. Stu, thank you as always, and we will speak soon, no doubt.
We certainly shall, my friend. Thank you very much indeed. It's been a blast.